Well, I don't know who's in charge of Fukuoka's farm these days, but if those seeds have in fact been lost, that's a sad reflection of the earnestness of claims by all sorts of organizations to be waging a war on hunger. Are they perhaps waging a war with a hand tied behind their back, or with technofix blinkers on, if they spend enormous amounts of time and energy to research GM crops or other advanced technologies that people could make money out of, but something as simple as saving the seeds, which have been shown to have a higher yield and which could certainly form the basis for future research, if that's not carried out, we can't be too surprised, because we know there's more than enough food for everyone in the world. It's a distribution problem. That is, it's a political problem. It suits the interests of certain powers to have a billion people in the world who are undernourished. Now, we recall Gatto's intimations a few shows ago of a conscious plan to break the US small farmer, to move food production from a distributed to a centralized basis. Here in Bangladesh, 3/4 of the people are still subsistence farmers. They have maintained a connection to the land, which has given them a wisdom to resist the earnest efforts made to move people from villages to the cities, where they can be more easily controlled and monitored. Now, last week we saw a number of ways in which the legal system, so-called, is in fact anything but systematic in its application, and is often basically just an excuse for an elite few to trample the intentions and the wishes of the many. Now, is there perhaps a connection with the fact that so many Bangladeshis are subsistence farmers, and that the law, especially in the villages, is widely understood to be a tool of the rich, which should be ignored as much as possible? Well, yeah, of course Bangladeshis aren't schooled or drugged into obedience in the same way that Americans are, so that's another factor. Now, we're going to hear the soundtrack of a film entitled Helen Nearing, Conscious Living, Conscious Dying, about two of the most famous Back to the Landers, who impacted a generation by the simple act of living a public life without electricity and subsistence farming. And the first voice you hear is that of the subject of the film, Helen Nearing.
Well, I think we're here for a purpose. I think we just, it's not dropped through the seed of our parents. I think we came from something and we're going to something. We have a past, we have a present, we have a future, and it's the present is what we've got to work with. And this is the way I would recommend young people to, if they're dissatisfied with the world as they find it, find some quiet spot, settle down, and self-subsist. Take care of their own needs. Make their own living. This seems such a sensible, normal, quiet, simple way of living. We never did it as with the thought of exemplars at all. It was just a decent way to live. This is not the only good life, but it's proved very good for Scott and me. Scott was much more erudite, much more educated, much more experienced than I was, and also he was 21 years older. So he had a lot to give me that I didn't have, and apparently I had a lot to give him, because we got on so compatibly for 53 years. I chose an admirable family to be born into. They gave me every opportunity to develop and to learn and to experience. My mother was a quiet, retiring beneficent influence who never obtruded herself but was there for the children when they wanted or needed her. She was an intellectual, an artist, a painter, very talented, but succumbed to family life and left her art and made her real art the growing of a family, the educating and nourishment of a family. My father was also an intellectual, a fine musician, but without having been able to practice it. I see pictures of myself at 3 or 4, and it's a non-entity to me as far as that's concerned. I was hardly in the body. When I left the family and went to girls' camp in New Hampshire, for the first time I was on my own, and I apparently developed an individuality that had not manifested at home. At 13, I began for the first time to really enter into life and take a part of it. Up to that time, I was an introvert and a bookish child who didn't enter into the life of the community at all. Well, I finally emerged and developed and rounded out a character which had not been there before. My family gave me the opportunity to either go to college in the United States or to a conservatory of music in the U.S. or travel and study and develop abroad, and I immediately jumped at the abroad. I was anxious and eager to experience a new life. And I never really was American from then on. And I was always rather a visitor here. In fact, I don't feel at home in life at all. I'm more interested in the meaning of life and the purpose of life and the background of life than I am living in Harborside, Maine. Still a visitor. When I was just 17, 2 weeks out of high school, my mother and I went to Holland, and I lived there for quite a few years. The first summer, I met Krishnamurti at a summer camp up in the northern part of Holland, and we became instantly friends for quite some years. He was a great revelation to me, and apparently I was a revelation to him. And our contact was close and good as long as it lasted. But Krishna's character and being remains a mystery to me to this day. I'm grateful for the opportunity to have been close to him for a time. I'm glad of the association and appreciative of the opportunity for loving and for being loved. It was a rare happening I would not have wanted to miss. It was also an edifying entrance into the stark realities of human relationships. Krishna moved on, and I moved on in different directions. Were Krishnamurti's teachings wasted on me? I probably digested as much as I was ready for, and much of the rest became part of my being in time. What was in the wings? The best thing that could have happened to me. I met Scott Nearing through a fortuitous phone call.
Helen LeConte, biographer of Helen Nearing.
Scott Nearing was a well-known social critic and a brilliant orator who was tried for treason at the height of World War I for claiming that corporate interests underlay the causes of the war. His dismissal from the economics faculty of the University of Pennsylvania caused sweeping protests, and his case became a test of First Amendment rights. He was acquitted of treason and gained another faculty position, but repeatedly attacked big business, protesting the use of child labor in American factories. Dismissed again for his radical views, he was blacklisted, and his books, which were once classroom standards, were actually taken out of print. Helen had met Scott a number of years earlier when she was home, and her father had asked her to invite Scott to speak at a Unitarian meeting, which Scott did. She hadn't paid much attention to him at the time. But she was asked by her father in 1928 to invite him back to speak. And at that time, they felt a connection. Scott may have noticed it even more than Helen did. And so in 1928, Helen began to work as Scott's secretary. He was separated from his wife, Nellie Seeds, at that time. And by 1929, it was clear to both of them that the relationship had more possibility than that, although they were still framing it as a working partnership more than as an intimate partnership. Scott suggested to Helen that she make a trip back to Europe to find out whether she wished to live in Europe or whether she was ready to do the hard work of becoming the assistant to a radical social critic and outcast.
Sometime in my youth or childhood, I must have done something good. Well, I must have done something good in former lives or so to have been able to meet these two great personalities, these two great men, and particularly lucky to have met Scott, because he had so much to communicate, and he was at such a blocked period in his life when I met him. He was at the lowest point in his career. So we started out at the bottom, scraping the bottom of the barrel together and living poorly in New York, in a very poor section of the slums. And we built a good life together from nothing. We had no money, we had no prospects, and his head was full of ideas and my head was full of music. Well, I don't think Scott could have met a different, a person who was more different than he was, with my background of no hard work, no mental discipline except learning to play the violin, and I could not have met a man more erudite and more politically minded than he. So it really was curious that we got along together.
Helen brought to him youth, enthusiasm, total unquestioning support for all his work. She brought her secretarial skills. She brought also her extraordinary hustle ability. Helen was a wonderful saleswoman and had a very good sense of how to advertise and promote. She did that for Scott's books. Neither of them knew exactly what they wanted to do. Scott had had a career. Helen hadn't had one. He was prepared to find a way to teach freelance in the world, and Helen was prepared to give him her full energies in that work. And at the time, at the outset, it wasn't much more than that. Except that, at that time, Scott was looking for a spiritual guide. And he found in Helen, he believed, an advanced soul, someone who could help him do the next piece of his learning. 1931, 32, Helen and Scott began looking for land in Vermont in order to survive the Depression in a way that was more appropriate than living in the city. When they moved to Vermont, they acquired what became the first forest farm, which consisted of a few hundred acres and an old rundown house. Scott was ready to live what he taught. He taught social justice. He would live in a way that would not consume more than other people had the opportunity to acquire. He would live responsibly on the land. He would teach freely if he could, not taking a salary for that.
Here's a person who clearly is sort of ahead of his time intellectually and on the cutting edge of where America is going culturally, which is also why you have somebody who today very much represents much of the sort of this cultural movement that we're seeing now in terms of what we call sort of the simple living movement, but very much is a questioning of consumerism, a questioning of American cultural values around this culture of consumption. And are there any other alternatives?
Scott continued to lecture in the winters and Helen to be his secretary. She learned how to garden. She learned how to build with stone. She learned that she loved it.
I was an absolute ignoramus as far as living in the country or growing a radish or a potato or a cauliflower were concerned. I knew nothing about it. I'd spend all my adolescent years playing the violin, I kept my hands clean. But when I met him, I put on Sears Roebuck work gloves and mixed concrete and laid stone and dug ditches and cut trees and garden and took to it with a will.
John Saltmarsh, biographer of Scott Nearing.
Scott and Helen decided very intentionally to live a life which was non-exploitive, which didn't use electricity, which didn't feed off of animals, which had a very ethical core to it. And wasn't that a stronger political statement than anything Scott had ever done before in his life? Whether it was getting arrested for citing the Constitution to challenge free speech laws, or whether it was running for Congress in 1918 and then again in 1928, or any of his work that he did on the left in this country or anywhere else around the world, that this person who had gone through all of that would arrive at a point where his strongest political statement was actually to live his beliefs.
Marketing of maple sugar in places like Manhattan brought them to the attention of several famous people. And when the famous began to discover them, the word about them got out, and other people with connections, book connections particularly, began to come to the farm. And then finally, at Perlbuck's suggestion, they wrote the maple sugar book. They became known for that, for the writing, and people came to see how they were living and sugaring in Vermont. And that meant that their life was public all along, from the beginning. They led a public life as well as a private life in Vermont. Helen and Scott had a number of specific practices they engaged in, which appear in the books like Living the Good Life. Things like dividing the day into three segments in their case that would allow them to participate in all the parts of their life they felt were important. One part would be the work in community. One part would be what they called bread labor, which was what they did to provide for themselves, the gardening, cutting wood, hauling wood, home building, that sort of work. And the other was the work of self-improvement, their personal studies, whether it was music in Helen's case or social science in Scott's case. And all of these were to come together in a way that allowed them to make contribution to their larger communities, both by being better, more conscious individuals and by being available to their communities in specific ways of teaching, allowing people to visit, and so forth. Scott continued to lecture worldwide, spent the goodly portion of every winter they lived in Vermont traveling by train and abroad and lecturing.
There was no plan in the 1930s that said on a piece of paper, this is what we will do and this is exactly how we'll work. It was all an experiment. And it turned out that certain things worked and certain things didn't, and it evolved into what then became a philosophy and a way of life, which they called the good life. But there was no predisposition towards that.
When ski development brought resort activity to their part of Vermont, Helen and Scott abandoned their successful homestead and started all over again in Maine in 1952. They lived quietly in Maine for many years, but by the early 1970s, over 2,500 people a year were visiting their homestead to experience the good life in action. There were three forest farms. The book Living the Good Life made the first one in Vermont famous. The book Continuing the Good Life made the last one in Maine famous. The middle house, though, was where a lot of the good life work really got done. In fact, most people that visited Helen and Scott during their most productive years know that middle clapboard house best. That's where the gatherings were. That's where Scott taught about stone building and dug the pond by hand. That's where they were able to cut all their own wood, and people learned about that story. But at the same time, they were writing Living the Good Life while they were living there. Those first years they lived there were when they wrote the book. Because they published it themselves, it didn't become famous until it was reissued by Schocken in the 1970s. So there was a long period where it was not the famous house. By the time that became famous, they were building and living in the last house. They were also doing a lot of their traveling in the world and lecturing together, visiting China, visiting the Soviet Union, and writing the books about the state of the world during that time, rather than writing books about their own lifestyle. So that made the middle house in the print record less well known.
If it weren't for Helen, we I think would have probably seen Scott disappear, and by the 1940s, 1950s, he would have been irrelevant to any discussion we would have about American culture. And Helen, who is able to bring Scott back to life, to find a purpose in the life, to figure out that there is this thing called the good life, which can actually be put together into philosophy and then ended up being, you can market this thing. So they put themselves out there on the extreme, living an alternative lifestyle, living a principled life, advocating those principles and living by them in a really, really strict way, to a degree that any kind of backsliding from that is readily apparent and seen as contradictions. When, in fact, you have to understand it as simply an experiment. And experiments don't have contradictions. They just have things that work and don't work, and you try other things.
From the beginning, she had really seen herself as his second fiddle, as his subsidiary, supporting his work, which only at some points was her work.
But somehow in moving up here, Scott receded more and was just he was content to be the background person that I had been in Vermont, which was curious. I took on the decisions and I arranged what was to happen with the house, and I designed this house and more or less built it under my direction.
Nancy Berkowitz, friend of Helen and Scott Nearing.
In the 70s, was a very exciting time to be in Harborside. Because people came from all over the country and coming to see Helen and Scott Nearing and some of the other people in the neighborhood. And it was a very remote area. We were 25 miles to the nearest small town that had a grocery store in it. So out in the middle of seemingly nowhere, sometimes, 100 people every couple of days would come down the driveway, and they were always people looking and searching for the same things that we who lived there were doing. People who wanted to simplify their life or figure out how to grow their own food.
Elliot Coleman, friend of Helen and Scott Nearing.
And when I read Living the Good Life, basically the idea of running a small farm with all the difficulties sounded like an adventure. And so that was the part that I delighted in, the fact that it was a challenge, the fact that it was difficult, the fact that it was real, and the fact that the Nearings were living their lives the way they thought it ought to be lived was what made them such a wonderful, wonderfully appealing couple. You read a lot of books, and the people when you meet them aren't the people that the book portrays. But Scott and Helen were right as they'd written it. They were honest, they were straightforward. They were difficult because they believed intensely in what they believed in and lived their lives according to their own little set of rules.
Internationalists, socialists, decentralists, naturalists, Helen and Scott Nearing have been an inspiration to thousands and thousands of people around the planet. You welcome the Nearings.
The Toward Tomorrow Fair, University of Massachusetts, Amherst. Helen Nearing sitting quietly, knitting the whole time.
Now for some practical details. Pay as you go.
There isn't anything that we want. We're trying to build up the soil, not to wear it down. And the way to build it up is to get every smidge of material that you can get your hands on and put it back into the soil.
Scott was a teacher. So to be a teacher, you always need to have a student or two. So when the people came to the garden and looked over the wall to talk to him, he kept on working, and then they would come into the garden.
And we've been here in this country for only 250 years. I mean, we white Western Europeans, and we lost about 40% of our topsoil during that time.
There are now 9 different families living on what was their original 140 acres here. So an awful lot of people came, and Helen Scott sold off different pieces of land, and I sold land to friends, and so it's turned into a whole community.
They were so open to sharing how they lived and what they believed in, so that, you know, if you had read their book or saw them at a lecture and went up to speak with them, they would speak with you and invite you to their home to see what could be done.
And so all people saw was the end point, and it looked relatively easy, right? I mean, you read Living the Good Life, this looks like a fairly simple course, so why can't I do it? And so many in the 70s begin to try this out and find that this is enormously difficult. That takes a lot of struggle and different ways of reconciling those struggles, and many people fail. And then they look at the earrings and say, they're hypocrites, right? They didn't really tell us the whole story. If they had, then we probably wouldn't have done this. This is all their fault.
With Helen and Scott, a lot of people didn't read between the lines, and they put them in a place where they didn't really need to be.
If the world thought they were wonderful, they were glad because it made it easier to get the message across. But I don't think that changed in any way what they thought about themselves. Unless maybe they worked a little harder at trying to be what the world wanted them to be than they might have if their lives hadn't been so public. But I don't think that was fake in any way, because they actually were that neat.
Keeping up with the Nearings was just another form of the rat race, right? Because they had set such a standard that you couldn't try to do this unless you were going to drive yourself crazy. On the other hand, I think that you have to recognize that the Nearings probably pushed much of the principles and practices that they were engaged in further than anyone else was pushing them.
You know, sometimes they'd like to be where it was warm, and so they would integrate working and lecturing with a trip to visit either old friends and family or for health reasons. When Scott was 99, Helen wrote to me and asked me to come and stay with him while she went away, because she knew we had a close relationship, Scott and I. So I did that, and then I ended up living with them in their house with them for the next year and a half till Scott died. And I did get left out of the book. But in retrospect, I can see there's some reasonings behind, because that particular book, her book, Loving and Leaving the Good Life, when she talked about her life with Scott and about his death, she didn't get real personal. She didn't really talk about her personal feelings about what it was like to lose a partner of 50 years. And she didn't get real personal about my involvement.
Scott and I were winding up our lives together, and we knew it. There were the physiological factors to be considered. How did he want to be treated? Where and by whom? I knew he desired to stay at home, not in a hospital, with life-saving apparatus all around. He would take no pills, no drugs, and hope to avoid doctors. He had become less and less concerned with continuing to inhabit a weakening body at 100. When he could no longer carry his part of the load and take care of himself, he was ready to go on. I was at one with him in this. The way one dies, it seems to me, should reflect the way one has lived, and I was glad to help him do it gracefully.
Scott always had to have a purpose in what he was doing. There had to be a reason for doing what you were doing, and it had to be justified. Otherwise, there was no point. And I think Scott reaches that point late in his 99th year where he decides that he has no purpose anymore. And it's at that point he can make the conscious decision that he will end his life. And I think that's the way Scott approached his death, that he would control it. As much as he controlled his life, he would control his death. So in the spring of 1983, Scott makes the decision that he's going to stop taking solid food. And slowly he would take in less and less. He would be awake less often. Like when I saw him, he was sleeping a good part of the day. He would do less and less work. He cut all the wood for the last year in that fall, but by the spring he could have never have done that. To the point where by August, when they have the party for his 100th birthday, he really isn't, I don't think he's really conscious much of the time of what's going on. And by later in that month, he's worked this process to its ultimate conclusion. But he had complete control over it.
Helen Nearing reads from Loving and Leaving the Good Life.
A month and a half before Scott went, a month before his 100th birthday, while sitting with a group at the table one day, he said, "I think I won't eat anymore." He never took solid food again. He deliberately and purposefully chose the time and the way of his leaving. It was to be methodical and conscious. He would cast off his body by fasting. He himself inaugurated his own technique for dying. Let the body itself give up its life. I acquiesced. For a month, I fed Scott just on juices when he wanted any liquids. Then he said, "I would like only water." Yet he did not sicken. He was still lucid and spoke with me, but his body was extremely emaciated. The life force in him was lessening. A week more on water, and he was completely detached from life, ready to slip easily into that good night. His body had dried up. Now it was withering away, and he could tranquilly and peacefully retire from it. Slowly, gradually, he detached himself, breathing less and less, fainter and fainter. Then he was off and free like a dry leaf from the tree, floating down and away. All right, he breathed, seeming to testify to the all rightness of everything, and was gone. I felt the visible pass into the invisible.
I've always, ever since almost childhood, been interested in what happens after you die. I was interested in aging and dying and death, and apparently Scott was too, and we centered our interest on that together. We read about it, we talked about it, and we sort of planned for it. And of course we planned first for Scott's death, because he was so much older, he probably would go first. And he decided that when he became more or less helpless and his body was worn out and sickening, that he would not linger on in a feeble way, that he would not go to a commercial home, that he would stay in his own home, and that he would die in his own time and at his own direction. And so he did, and so I will do.
She remembers it as being short and quick and no pain, and the fact that it wasn't exactly like that, I guess I don't have a real big problem with it, except for the people who read her book and can't read between the lines.
My life was not over and done with. So a chapter ended when Scott, comrade and love of 53 years, quietly breathed away his life at home in Maine 3 weeks after his 100th birthday. He went with dignity, purposefully, fasting, after a long and a good life. I had to pick up the reins that had been held loosely in his hands. When Scott left, I had to carry on alone. He had had me to help him at the end of his life, and I now faced the end of my life without him. But I decided to carry on as if he were there, to keep the place open, to let people come, to see the gardens, to even help me, but not to live with me. I preferred to live alone if I couldn't live with Scott.
She kept open house and did many, many lectures up right up until the time she died. and found that that was something that was fulfilling for her. Even though it was strenuous at times, she did feel fulfilled by having a job to do.
First winter that I was alone, I answered all of those letters and telegrams and wires and cards by hand, sort of wound up the whole experience, and then got on with my own life.
And there were several stages Helen went through of recovering herself, first by learning what she'd been for Scott and writing about that in her memoir, what they had been for each other, and beginning to understand what their life had meant and was still meaning for other people, which gave her a sense of accomplishing something worthy and being engaged in a service to those who wanted to learn how to live more mindfully and consciously.
I don't think Helen either was quite as surprised as she used to pretend she was that people kept coming and were interested, because Helen had been so equally involved with Scott and in all the ideas that I always thought that it was just perfectly natural for her to carry on. If she showed any reluctance at all, it's because there's an awful lot of work, daily work, in maintaining a homestead and growing your own food and cutting your wood and everything, and it's pretty difficult to do it alone. It was far harder for her once Scott was no longer there.
Helen, this is amazing transformation, which really you could only describe in one way sort of as a blossoming, but really in a deeper way it's an identity transformation. She finds herself in a way that she just had never found herself before, because Scott was always determining what that identity would be. And that's the Helen that we know in the last decade and a half of her life. And it's actually a wonderful transformation, this woman who comes alive in her 80s and 90s. It's the Helen who can give life advice. It's the Helen who has become, in a very sort of ancient sense, this shaman-like priestess. She's the religious center of this larger community. And in a culture where we don't value older people anymore, she's valued in such a way that a number of people would express to me that they knew Helen and felt really deeply about Helen. They saw her very infrequently, but would say to me that if Helen weren't around, I would really feel a loss. I mean, we don't have people like that in our culture anymore. So she ended up in this very unusual sort of situation as this sort of elder of the community. And it wasn't a local community, it was a wide community.
I never have taken the outside of life too seriously. I've always felt a connection to the meaning and purpose of life. This is a day in school. And I'd like to profit by it, I'd like to learn from it, I'd like to contribute. But the real life, with a capital L, is behind all this scenery. And I'm anxious to get there and experience that. But I still have to live my day in school. So as long as the old body can continue, as long as the brain can still do a bit of vocalization, I'll stay here, but I'm on my way somewhere else, in transition. And in a sense, I don't take all I see around me too seriously. It's beautiful, I appreciate it, but it has a deeper meaning than shows on the surface.
Scott, in his autobiography, Making of a Radical, wrote very clearly about this continuum of the life force. And he believed as strongly as Helen did in something like reincarnation, that when this body that they were in ceased, they did not. Whatever their essential self was, capital S if you like to do it that way, would persist, would continue in some fashion. And that, for them, removed all sense of fear about endings. They really fully believed that, like a snail leaving its shell, and Helen referred to her body as a shell, when this ceased, it was only this physical material thing that ceased, that they were still on a journey back toward whatever God is and toward participating in that being more manifest in life.
We never have used the word God. I never used the word God. But the whole of manifestation is an experiencing by some great thing and some great purpose. And I ally myself with that, and I want to participate in that experience, and I want to add my might to it. But my might is not, my MITE is not separate from the purpose. It's part of it. And whatever there is that people call God is a growing thing, an evolving thing. And it's just as important that that little dandelion there on the grass has its life and manifests as it is that I or some greater being manifests. Life is all a tremendous unity and a learning unity and an evolving unity, and we're part of it, and we're lucky to be part of it, and it is us and we are it. We're lucky.
They were both comfortable with the term cosmic consciousness. Scott had come to the relationship trying to find a way to bring cosmic consciousness to his work, his social science and politics and economics. Helen came with the theosophical teaching about brotherhood and living in service to your fellow humans. And that was really the work they were trying to do all along. That was the base work. How they lived the good life that we know of now was a way of practicing living in a way that would honor what their belief system was and this larger sense of there being continuity of the life force.
We were always interested in what lay behind life and what life was for and what life was leading to, and we thought that death was certainly a part of the process. So I separately, before I met Scott, and he, before he met me, was interested in the subject of death. We even joined a mortuary society here in Maine, in Auburn, and paid $65 each for our future cremation, so that when Scott had died, I already had made the arrangements, and a friend, a neighbor here in the on the Cape, had made a nice wooden box, and Scott stipulated the size and said no ornamentation on it, and he wanted to be put in his work clothes in it and driven in the back of the truck to the crematorium, which I did, and it didn't seem as if I were leaving Scott at all. It was just leaving an old body. And he stayed with me in all aspects but the physical. Already I feel pretty well thoroughly detached from physical events and happenings and daily doings. I'm partway there myself right now, and I wouldn't mind if I went tomorrow or today.
I don't mind how it comes, and I don't mind how soon it comes. It'll either come through an accident or my feeling feebler. You can hope for me that I go before 100.
I don't know if all old age is this way or not, or if I really am preparing and really am half over there, but I have to jerk myself into existence to stay here. And I sincerely hope that it's not too long, maybe one or two more years, and the darn body is still quite strong. The mind is is softening and forgetting, as you kind of noticed today. But I'm not attached to this at all, and I'm not attached to this at all. And I'm more than half over there. Didn't H.G. Wells say more or less the same thing to an interviewer when he came? He said, "Don't be bothering me. I'm preparing to die." And that's the case with me, even though my body is fairly strong, fairly well.
Clearly Helen was ready to go. She made that known to everybody. She was very comfortable with the notion of dying. She clearly had it planned in terms of what she wanted to happen when she did die, who she wanted to have around her, what exactly the ritual would look like. And it was played out pretty much exactly as she had intended. I think that actual event itself will always be a mystery.
The days before she died, she was terribly tired. She'd taken on a great deal of responsibility for a number of visitors who were coming, and not just visiting, but staying in the house. And her voice was very tired, and she was very tired and very frustrated with not sleeping well. On the day that she died, she called here and let us know how tired she was, and that she was going to run away from home, basically, and spend the afternoon in a movie theater in Ellsworth, which was a half an hour from home. We were anxious about that because Helen hadn't driven for a long time. Her eyes were failing. It was a gray day. The roads were wet. It was just the wrong kind of day for her to drive on. But she really needed to be away from home so that she would not have to deal with too many visitors that afternoon because she was so tired. The phone call came from a friend that Helen had been in a car accident and was at the hospital and had either died or was dying. The accident itself involved speeding and slippery roads, and she ran into a tree, and Helen didn't believe in wearing seatbelts, broke her neck, and to the best of our understanding, died instantly. Three friends of Helen's had been summoned who lived closer by and were there at the hospital. The good thing was that the young man who was on the service, the emergency service that day, knew who Helen was and knew that she would want not to be resuscitated, that she would be want to let go.
I mean, they all knew. There was no sort of huddling at the hospital to figure this out. They knew, and they carried it out with such precision that it had to be something that Helen had said that she wanted, and that they would all, and they were all disciples enough that they would carry this out no matter what.
We were just the women who hung around her and just sort of took care of some of her daily needs and stopped in to see if she needed anything at the store and things like that. So, you know, we just happened to be her attendants.
And the day it happened, I got a phone call, and all I could think of, well, I actually called your house, Diane, and your daughter said that you went up to the hospital. And so I went up to the hospital, too. Just I wanted to be wherever everyone was and where Helen was. And I got there, and everyone had left. In fact, they said in the hospital, they have all gone out the harbor side.
In death as in life, Grace carried Helen and carried the day. Because the young emergency room doctor knew Helen, he was aware that she would not want to be held in a hospital. And we were allowed, after paperwork was signed, within the hour of her death, to kidnap her. So we put her in the car, drove her home, and began then to deal with how to let her public know that she was gone.
Then we got home, and it's okay, it's pouring rain. Now we have to take her out of the car. And first we spent a lot of time doing like this stuff to get ready, and it's ready, and it was like, but Helen is out there. We really do need to bring her in now.
We cared for her. We washed her and clothed her and laid her out on one of the benches in her living room. Had some, you know, beautiful Guatemalan cloth and beautiful flowers and herbs and pictures of Scott and her parents and people that she loved. And then we had a 6-hour silent kind of meditation where people could come and pay their last respects to Helen. Thank you. neighbor had made a wooden coffin, and we put her in that and drove her to Auburn to the crematorium where Scott had also been cremated, and we delivered her body there, and then her ashes came back and we spread them around the place like Helen and I did with Scott's. It was a good thing. You know, she didn't suffer and she didn't have to spend any time at the hospital. She was always saying that she didn't want anyone to have to fuss over her or take care of her. I don't think that she would have enjoyed the dying process the way Scott's death was. His was a number of months of us caring for him, and Helen would have been much too impatient for something like that.
But there was a great deal of concern that she might have committed suicide, because there was clearly nothing wrong with the car, and people just wondered if she would have done that. For two reasons, Helen wouldn't have committed suicide. One, that if you believe in reincarnation, to kill yourself is to deny God the opportunity to have the time he's going to have with you in your lifetime, to have whatever that transcendent experience might be of passing when the time is ready. It would ruin all her good karma, whatever she'd gathered, to have committed suicide. That is not something she would have ever considered. And she would certainly never have chosen a tree to kill herself against, because it might have harmed the tree. Turned out that it didn't. There was no harm caused to the tree. But it's simply not a package that Helen would have put together.
I never thought that she committed suicide. No. I think it was just her time.
Every entity, every act is a part of the great manifestation. Every living thing has its note, its song, its contribution through every moment of its existence. As we live our lives, we leave our mark. Whatever the world may be like 100 years from now, it will be influenced in part by what each one of us has been, has done, and thought. So the marks of my parents, my brother and sister, my longtime love and husband Scott Nearing, and I myself have made together and separately have helped shape the world, have influenced other lives, and the lives of you who may read these pages or hear these words.
When you think of all the people who've read Living the Good Life and the effect that has had, how many human beings in their life get a chance to influence in a very positive way, especially if you think of what we understand now about the world and its resources and the fact that we cannot continue to consume at the rate that they were actually, in a way, reacting against. The effect they have had on making people realize that there is a good life in living more simply, oh yeah, I think that's an enormous accomplishment.
Years from now, when you and I are long gone, there will be this couple which in a really deep sense represents a way of living which steps outside of the cultural framework that they were living in a really powerful way, which says that there are certain principles which are almost transcendent, which are really important principles which we must live our lives by in our everyday being.
Perhaps there's only one sin, separateness, with the blessedness of love making all whole. I feel that life is such a unity that love which once happened still exists. It is there on the record. Love once felt has its place. The love I had for and received from Scott, the love for and from countless women and men I have known, is still vibrating in the world. Everyone who feels I love adds to the heavenly glow. The love that has been felt all through the ages, everywhere, all through time, what a shining, what an eternal process and presence. Love is the source, love the goal, and love the method of attainment. A network of love crisscrosses the globe. The delicate, shining lines form a tenuous web from one end of the world to the other. There are so many threads of love in the world, so much love going on for and from so many people. To have partaken of and to have given love is the greatest of life's rewards. There seems never an end to the loving that goes on forever and ever. Loving and leaving are a part of living. If somebody else had written the book, I might have liked it myself.
One of the things I've noticed about living in Bangladesh is that love comes up a lot more in conversations. It's much less confused with sex than it is in Western culture, and they have multiple different words for different types of love. I think to a certain extent this may reflect that people are still in touch with what is important in life. They haven't been super saturated in trivialities. This is a country where a lot of villages still do not even have electricity, never mind televisions, although technology is coming there. Death is a topic that John Taylor Gatto remarks is an embarrassment to the project of the techno fix, because they've made so little progress at eliminating it. I find in the West, death is a topic that is little reflected upon, and old people are cleared out of the way into warehouses, which, with the best will in the world, I don't think merit the term care home. That would be pretty unthinkable for a Bangladeshi to say that you decided to move your mum and dad out of the house, because people live together here in families a lot, to say that they'd gotten a bit old and it was a hassle to have them around, so you ship them off somewhere else. How many times on this show we've reflected on the limited understanding of the world that's broadcast through commercially controlled media, how statistics never tell the full story. If we look at life expectancy in the US, that may be longer than Bangladesh, I'm sure it is, but what does that tell us about the nature of those lives? To say nothing of the old people who are warehoused in some particular home, or youngsters imprisoned in an institution not of their choosing. Whilst you can look at economic terms and say these people are very poor, they lack the most basic necessities, you can also reject the concept of materially defined poverty and see that people are rich in terms of relationships, rich in terms of autonomy, clear of physical pollution a lot of the times, and certainly mental pollution. Their lives, in summary, are their own. In terms of food security, which is, I think, a consideration that is only going to rise in importance as peak oil starts to bite, who is rich and who is poor? Someone living in an American city or someone in a Bangladeshi village? What about in terms of cultural heritage? Well, these are open questions, but there is a wholeness and a realness to life here in Bangladesh, even in the city, which is one of the things that I found lacking in a lot of Western life. If you'd like to download this show, or any of the 570 previous shows, you can do so at our website, unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep it.